This is Norman Lear with my great sidekick, Paul Hipp.
Good to be here with you, Norman, on All of the Above.
That's the name of my podcast, All of the Above. And it's called All of the Above because we're going to talk about all of the above. There isn't anything sacrosanct.
There's nothing too above us or below us.
Or below us. Well, certainly nothing too below us. But we have had guests you cannot believe.
Yeah.
Guests.
Julie Louis-Dreyfus, amazing.
Yes. And America Ferrera.
Jared Carmichael.
Yes. Oh, Amy Poehler. How did we overlook? We didn't overlook Amy Poehler. I was saving her for last. And Charles Barkley, I was saving him for first, actually, because I didn't declare up first.
I get to hang out with this guy. And this is your chance to hang out with Norman Lear a little bit here and some of these great guests.
God, I wish I was you hanging out with Norman Lear.
Yeah.
Son of a gun. See? That must be exciting.
It's the best. I'm telling you.
Don't miss All of the Above with Norman Lear. Download new episodes every week on the Podcast One app or subscribe at PodcastOne.com.
Recorded live at Corolla One Studios with Adam Carolla and board-certified physician and addiction medicine specialist, Dr. Drew Pinsky. You're listening to The Adam and Dr. Drew Show.
Yeah, get it on. Got to get on. The judge with a gun. I'm going to get it on. Thanks for tuning in. Dr. Drew still on the road. Dr. Spaz filling in quite nicely.
How dare
you. For Dr. Drew. Call, I'm curious about Miranda.
Aloha, Adam Carolla. How are you? I missed your live broadcast today because my phone was, like, tweaked or something, or I don't know, maybe it's operator error, but so I'm calling in because I have a question I've been wanting to ask you for a long time.
37, Sacramento, yes.
Well, actually, it's Chico, but nobody really knows where Chico is.
And I know where Chico is.
So
well, thank you.
Sacramento.
Okay. Yeah, what's going on?
Okay, so you did a podcast with Dr. Drew, and a guy called in, and he said he wanted to be a police officer, but he kept failing the psychological exam, and he had been in the military, and he said it was because he doesn't have a normal reaction to fear, and I'm the exact same way. Like, things that scare the average person don't scare me. It's like it's not even happening. And you said that you could relate to that, but it was because your parents were not protective of you. But see, I had the exact same response that you have. I grew up with incredibly overprotective parents. So what do you think? So what do you think it is now? Because I'm the complete opposite end of the spectrum. Like, I grew up with a mother that was like, "Oh, you can't do this. You can't do that. You could get raped, mugged, and torched." And it's like, it was horrible. And then when I was like 18. I moved out, lived in the dorms, went to college, and I got left in Mexico at 20, and I'm just hanging out, literally left with nothing. I didn't have my passport, I didn't have my ID, nothing. My friends went back because I had gone up with Chico State, but I started hanging out with all the kids from Santa Barbara, and they just assumed that I was hanging out with one of the parts. They went back, and everyone's oh my God, you could have died.
There's a couple things. First off, you kind of realize, statistically, I've done a million things in Tijuana, and everyone goes, "Oh, you wouldn't want to go there." And it's you're fine. I mean, statistically, higher chance.
Yeah, but you're a boy.
That's true. Higher chance of getting raped in Tijuana than Orange County. But it is a thing where we are very fear-based. We're not that statistically based. We're much more fear-based. Well, let me ask you this. I don't know what creates this. I have a very low pulse rate, and
me too. I have a really low blood pressure too, because my brain goes really fast, but and a mellow person. I think I have ADD, because my brain goes really fast, but I'm not hyper. I don't twitch or anything.
If I stand in the street and a car backfires, everyone will jump, but I won't jump.
And I won't jump. Yep.
It's not a conscious thing. It's just I don't jump. It doesn't make me. It doesn't startle me.
Right.
The other.
Yeah, but see, with that said, what happens when the phone rings? That gets my attention. If my phone sends a text message or the phone rings, that'll totally instantly grab my attention. But if I hear a car backfire, I don't give it a second thought. I don't even respond.
How is it? How many car accidents have you been in?
Let's see. Oh, my gosh. That's a really good story. Okay, so my friend Brian Wilson, he ended up killing a kid in college. He was a frat boy. He ended up killing kids like a year later with alcohol poisoning. But he picked us up when I was 19. I lived in a sorority house, and he was wasted, and I didn't know it. And he had a brand new Suburban, and he picked us up and crammed all of us girls in the back of the Suburban. And we went up to like Highway 32, and he started spinning around with like driving really fast, and he slammed it into a tree. All the windows went flying out. I got a horrid bloody nose. And he was, like, out of his gourd, and he takes his shoes off and goes and sits on the hood, like, right over a cliff. We were just about to go over the cliff, like, literally teeter-tottering. And he goes, I just want to get a feel for the moment. And I just sat there, and, like, all the girls were, like, hysterical. And I was kind of like, okay, this guy's going to Cooper Cocoa Puffs in front of all of us. But I didn't, like, freak out, and the girls were, like, crying. And I'm just, like, sitting there, like, calm, but, like, are we going to die? Like, kind of thing. So I got in a car accident. I got flight lifted one time when I got sideswiped, and I got flight lifted to Mercy San Juan in a helicopter.
Helicopter. Wow.
A helicopter, yeah. It's just so you know, it's a $50,000 trip. $50,000 for one helicopter ride, one way, $50,000. Yeah.
You're still alive, though, so that stops.
I'm still alive.
Yeah.
Strong.
Are you married?
No, I'm divorced. I have an ex-husband. It has your birthday, by the way, but I won't hold that against you.
I knew he was a Gemini.
May 27th, right?
Gemini. This is the work of a Gemini.
Yeah.
Matt knows I'm a Gemini.
Yeah, personalities. He's a piece of work.
Yep. Yeah.
Yep. You guys are very similar, though. He has the ENTP personality, and he was actually in law school when we got
What kind of personality do we have?
It's ENTP. It's the extroverted, extroverted, intuitive thinker, perceiver, and it's the ENTP, and it's the lawyer type. It means everything's like black or white. But see, what's different about you and him is like you'll argue for like something that like is legit, but with him, he would argue with professors and stuff. He has a master's degree in business now, but he would argue just for the sake of arguing. Like we could go stare at a wall that is completely caught in white, and he'll say, that wall's black. Just to get an argument, and then once you start, like, it's just kind of like you go along with it, then he'll turn around and be like, no, I told you it was white. Why do you say it's black? So
Ryan, hold on a second. Go ahead.
We had a guest on when Drew and I did the podcast, James Fallon, and he was the guy that he wrote the book, The Sociopath Within. So he's a professor of neuroscience at Irvine, and found that he had the brain structure of a sociopath. And so started looking into – because they
– I heard about this guy.
Right. They don't react the same way emotionally, empathy-wise. And one of the issues is the MAOA gene and the brain being bathed in serotonin in utero and then not having the same reaction to fear, stress, or not empathizing as much. So part of what she's describing can be attributed to genetics. And then what he was describing was, what's the difference? He finds out he has the same brain structure as these people who are studying serial killers, and yet he's not exhibited that behavior himself. Mm-hmm. But he does have certain tendencies towards lack of empathy and mirroring healthy behaviors rather than feeling to do the right thing. So part of it is your genetics, the neuro. You know, when you describe, you don't have the adrenaline produced in certain situations where other people would. So it's a matter of your genetics and then the environment that produced the behavior you have. So that's a great book. If James Fallon, if you look at the things he's written, I think it helps to explain some of these issues.
I asked her if she ever got in a car accident, because I attribute never getting in a car accident with extreme hypervigilance. It's constantly watching people and judging them and judging what they're doing before they do it.
What about auto racing? Your ability to do that, isn't that the same? You can't develop. There's certain things you can develop, but that's an innate skill that someone has to have. I think with auto racing, you have to be able to. You're dealing with highly stressful situations, quick response, and
the thing that's interesting about the auto racing, I would say for me, more so than the actual being competitive or being good at it, is I can, but it's actual kind of it's a weird thing. So I've always been interested. I've always thought about it as it pertains to balance. But here's how it goes. I've always told people I have really good balance. And what really good balance does is it makes you really good at stuff really fast, but it doesn't necessarily make you that doesn't make you great at it. It's just like for instance, if somebody, I could probably, you know, the first time I went water skiing, I was up on one ski in about 10 minutes and I was going back and forth slaloming in 15 minutes. And it looked like I've been doing it since I was a kid. It just made me, it makes you good at stuff fast. It's the balance. I don't know why I always think it's the balance, but the thing that I'm able to do, but it doesn't really, the problem is it doesn't really pay off at the end, which is to say, I can go down to Willow Springs, I can go get into that 850 horsepower Corvette, and the inside of it looks like a rocket ship. It's just switches everywhere and toggles and buttons and hoses and stuff like that. And I can just go get into it. And the stick shift is not anything I'm used to driving because it's sequential. You just keep pulling it backwards or you push it forward. And I put cheat sheets on the dash, you know, with the numbers written on it for the shifting pattern and stuff like that. And by lap... by lap four, I'm pretty much 7/8 of where I need to be by lap four in this completely different car that I've never even driven before. And by lap 25, I'm as fast as I'll ever be in a weird way. Like one of the things that was weird is I drove pea shooters. I drove 510s and roadsters and 200 horsepower four-cylinder cars.
Right.
One day, we got out Newman's big turbo car with the big slicks and the 600 horsepower and blah, blah, blah. And we brought it to Laguna Seca for like winter speed days, as they call it, just for testing and get some seat time. I pulled it out onto the track and I have a TrackMate thing that's on my phone. It keeps track all your laps, tells you how your average speed and best lap and blah, blah, blah. And so we had the thing Wednesday, Thursday. We're going to drive the car on the track. I went out Wednesday morning, drove the car, drove about four or five laps. I got some heat into the tires and turned like a 136 in change. And the next day, I was like, okay, well, now, you know, it's the first time I was in the car. I didn't improve it the whole weekend. I've never improved it really in that car. I drove this crazy turbo, big slick, fire breathing, weird beast of a car at Laguna Seca. And on about the fifth lap, turned my fastest lap I ever turned. And I think I still don't turn any faster laps than that, even though I've driven a lot. So I don't improve. But you do get up on things fast. You can handle stuff that seems like it would take a long time to digest quickly. By the time I did this Trans Am race, by the time the race came around on Sunday, I was just a Trans Am driver.
Now, what about ball sports, basketball, baseball? Did you have the same? Because I'm just curious about the coordination effect. And then you're talking about there's a risk factor involved in racing that there's really not in other sports, most of it.
I could always pick up the, you know why I could pick up the sports, basketball, baseball, or whatever. There's a lot of people that would watch a basketball game, or you watch a boxing match, or you watch a guy swinging a baseball bat, and you think, oh, that's what I look like when I shoot the ball. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to do the one hand with the touch and the release and the whole thing. And then you watch videotape of you shooting the ball, and it doesn't look anything like what's going on in your head. You know, I remember once Jimmy and I were like filming a thing. It was a football thing, and it was a whatever thing. And he had a kick, and I was like, run up, plant that left foot, turn your hips like kicking. He's like, I am doing that. And I was like, no, you're not. You could barely. Doesn't even look like you're doing it, you know? And he's like, that's what I'm doing. And I was like, no, just get a run, plant that foot, twist. And it's like, in his mind, it's exactly what he was doing. What I was seeing was We all are guilty of that.
Right,
sometimes
right.
It's with singing. You know what I'm saying? But what I'm saying is this. For whatever gifts I had, it would be perfect for a movie. If you're making a movie about a place kicker, I could look like I was a place kicker. I couldn't kick the ball. I couldn't kick a 50-yard field goal.
Right.
You would just watch me and go, oh, that guy looks like he kicks the ball.
Advanced
with sports, that guy can throw a punch or that guy can swing a baseball bat. I could physically watch people on TV do it and then know what the stance looked like, where the elbow was, where the hands were twisted, with the hips turning. I could emulate and mimic that, thus making you good at whatever it is, like almost immediately, but never really making you great at it, just making you look competent.
But where does coaching come into things? And with professional athletes, I always wonder, there's the natural ability, and how much more does coaching help them achieve another 5%, 10%?
It helps. There's a lot of...
I mean, do you get a bunch of points? Would it help you if you had somebody intensively training you further to improve your car racing, or is it just a recreational thing in your...
It would. I mean, I just went out, got in this crazy car, and just sort of competed. And
yeah,
I know. It wasn't really... I don't know what coaching... It never hurts, but yeah. I don't know what it would have done. I could have used a little, break a little earlier here and get on it a little faster out of turn eight or something. But I don't think it made a big difference.
Interesting.
For me. But here's what I tell people all the time. If you throw yourself into situations where you're driving all these different cars all the time and all these different environments, nothing really seems very intimidating. Like, it should be very intimidating climbing into that car, but it's not because of all the different experiences. So if you can get out and expose yourself to all these different experiences, I mean, we were going out to grid up for the race, and I don't think my heart was beating at all. I didn't have any kind of hesitation.
Anxiety.
Thank you. It's a good way to do it. By the way, I always tell people, if you got anxiety, you can't get in the car because the whole thing is claustrophobic.
I rented a Camaro. I love driving it, but a little claustrophobic.
You got to really get into one of these cages and get the net up and get the harnesses going and get your helmet and your headgear and your Hans, your head and neck restraint system and stuff. It really, you feel like...
And that didn't ever get your anxiety up. See, that's part of this genetic thing, I think. And you're being raised as a whatever.
Latchkey kid?
Yeah.
Never. All right. I'll tell you guys about LifeLock. What do we got here? Your internet browser history. Data, man. Can be sold to advertisers by internet service providers thanks to the bill that just got passed by Congress, signed by Trump. So let's protect ourselves. Identity theft. It's America's fastest growing crime. That's why I have LifeLock. Lynette has it. The kids have it. LifeLock, it scans hundreds of millions of transactions each second. If they detect your info, they send you an alert. And if you have a problem, their U.S.-based agents will work to fix it. They don't outsource. They're U.S.-based. They're LifeLock. No one can prevent all identity theft or monitor all transactions at all businesses, but LifeLock is the best protection available, and memberships start at just $9.99 a month. That's $9.99 a month for LifeLock, everybody. Let's get going. Bruce, LifeLock.
Go to LifeLock.com or call 1-800-LIFELOCK. Use promo code ADAM. That's ADAM for 10% off your LifeLock Ultimate Plus membership. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK, 1-800-LIFELOCK.
All right, let's talk to this guy. Paul, 43, Minnesota. Paul?
Hi, Adam. Hi, guys.
Good.
Up here in Minnesota, there's a guy on the radio in the morning. He does like a Hollywood report. His name is Mike Evans.
Mm-hmm.
I think he worked at K-Rock back in, a long time ago, I guess. But he's like a Hawaiian guy or whatever, and older dude. And he took a couple of days off because he said he was doing a documentary for Netflix about the early days of K-Rock. Mm-hmm. I just wonder if you were aware of that, or maybe if he was considered you for your documentary, or
I think what? We were interviewing him. I know the name. I know there was Raimondo and Evans that were on in the morning back in the day. I think that might be.
I don't really know. I just know that he's on. What, he comes on Tom Bernard's radio show in the morning, like at 7 o'clock every morning. He does like a Hollywood Report.
Well, I don't think he's making a documentary. I think he's
no. He said that he was going to be interviewed for one.
Yeah, that's ours.
Oh, well,
pretty
that's
sure.
Cool.
Yeah. Pretty sure. We've been interviewing a lot of people, and I'm doing a TV show, so I've not been there for everything. So I don't know everything that's going on all the time.
Okay. I have one other question. The thing about the racing and all that stuff I heard you guys talking about while I was at home.
Yeah.
That's just balls, man. that's what it is. Is that you do something and you're... It gives you the confidence to go on and do something else, and I think that's how you led your whole life. I think I don't know you. I listen to you, but I don't know you. But it seems like that's the way you lead your life. It's just like, hey, screw it, let's go on to the next thing and see if it works.
Yeah, I do. I you know it's loud and it kind of seems dangerous, but I don't feel like it's that dangerous. Once you can get over all the sound and the speed and everything,
I called you one other time. I talked to you about my nephew that was in the he couldn't play regular sports. He got into drag racing and stuff.
You're right.
And it was kind of the same thing with him. And then he wasn't afraid to get in front of people and start talking. And then an update: he just got a internship to go out to Yellowstone to go work out there all summer long. You know, helping people hike and stuff like that. And he rappels off mountains and all kinds of crap. And, you know, he was just a scared little kid back then, but he just, you know, grew a set of nuts.
Paul. Yeah, no, it definitely, doing stuff that's scary and doing it enough does kind of help out. It's not, I don't know who's fear-based. I feel like a lot of, I'm not fear-based. A lot of people are, my whole family, they're fear-based, you know. It's a kind of a, you know, if you say to Lynette, let's go do this, she'll go like, well, what happens if you fall into the river and drown? You know, you'll go like, oh, I'm not planning on it. What if we have a kick-ass time? She's like worried about the kids, you know. She's I don't want to call her fear-based. My mom is, well, actually, there's two types. My mom is fear-based and it's negative fear-based. Like, you know, you just go, I'm going to keep the house. I'm going to rent it out. Well, what if a bunch of bikers move in and cook up meth? It's like, all right, well, maybe a gay couple moves in and pays all the rent in advance in cash. Like, I don't know. I'm not counting on the bikers moving in cooking meth.
Yeah. Some of it's passive aggressive, too, I think, in your experience with some of these individuals.
Could be.
And then there's also a look at cognitive behavioral therapy, though. I think some people can learn to work through and look at a certain situation and alter the amount of anxiety they're going to have or how they respond. But I just think there's a certain genetic – there's certain something you have that you just can't go out and race. I just went to the Winter Nationals. I remember the last time I went with you guys, and just the sound and the absolute brutal, you know, shaking that occurs. I don't think I could get in one of those cars and ever develop the stamina or get over the initial adrenaline to do that, no matter what kind of training I had. It's just not something I'd want to do.
Right. Well, again, it's like maybe you want to do it or maybe you don't want to do it, but if you push through it, I don't know. I'm trying to get Sonny to learn to ride a bicycle. So. Can Joey ride a bicycle?
He could ride. He actually can ride a unicycle.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, he picked that up quickly.
Well, he's got good balance, that boy. All right, let's see. Let's talk to Alex, 19. Alex?
Hi, Adam.
What's going on, Alex?
Nothing much. So my question is, when you felt, so I read your book, If It Did, Will Be Chicks, and I loved it.
Thanks.
And you know when you said, oh, you didn't know how to read?
Yes.
When you got out of high school?
Yes.
How did you explain to your girlfriend when you kind of mentioned that you did not believe that you were longer than you felt you need to talk to him about it.
Well, I didn't have any. I'm put on hold. It's got a bad line. When I got out of high school, I took a good 12 years off of reading anything. I didn't have to read anything. I didn't work in an environment where reading was necessary. I never read a book. I never put myself in a position to read, and I never did anything. At a certain point, as far as girlfriends go, they didn't ask to, you know, pass an SAT score. They just wanted to make sure you were nice and semi-fit. But as far as the reading goes, it wasn't until I got into probably into like Acme Theater and Groundlings and stuff like that when people would show up, and I could remember like people write bits, you know, and then it'd show up with like 4 or 5 pages stapled together, and they'd go, "Hey, here you go, Adam. I want you to play Hank, the farmer," you know, and then they'd hand out the stuff, and "I want you to play the gay florist, and you play this." And I'd just be looking at this thing going, my problem with reading was not only couldn't I not really read, I'd look at the page and go, "Where's Hank, the farmer?" And they'd go, "It's on the top of the first page." And I go, "I don't see..." And then they just come over and like point, "Hank the farmer." And I'd go, "Oh, okay. Yeah, I see it now. I see it now." And then I'd have to highlight it because I couldn't just track it. I couldn't find it. You know what I mean? Like once they started, I would just listen for other people to turn the page. And I always knew if there was silence on stage for more than 4 seconds, it was me who wasn't keeping up and didn't know what the next thing was. And I would literally... If you gave me 3 or 4 pages with just a couple little paragraphs or whatever, I'd have to go highlight it and stand out in the parking lot and read it 10 times straight through to even come close to having a chance of pulling it, of coming close on stage. Like I'd have to read it 10 times and 10 times to just have a outside chance that I wouldn't stumble and bumble and trip over whatever was next.
I'm sure you don't remember this, but when I first started filling in on Loveline, when you were there, I think the second time I brought you a book to read, it was called, I think, Drama of the Gifted Child. And you sort of grunted and took it. And then I think I asked Drew afterwards, like, and he just started cracking up. Because so you gave Adam a book.
Right.
And I asked you later, I was like,
I couldn't physically follow along. I couldn't find my place. It was more of a sequencing thing than an actual reading thing. It was like I would just get lost along the line. I'd go down to the end of the line and start back at the beginning of the sentence again. I wouldn't drop down.
Right.
But there's a lot of trouble with the sequential part of it. Not even so much like I wasn't spelling out, I wasn't sounding out words. It was more like I couldn't follow along.
And so respectfully, that's a learning disability, technically. And because, wait a second, when you recall stuff that's been said verbally, I just know stuff from like the No Doubt thing and you got in trouble. I was there doing that show and then I recounted it and you went, no, that's not the way it went. And then you recounted it and it was like, wow, it was like word for word. So you can remember stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That's spoken,
yes,
almost like a photographic visual memory person does.
I hear things, and when I hear them, that's the way they were said.
Right.
And that's why it always drives me nuts when people go, "No, it's not what you – no, yeah. I told you." And I'm like
– right. No. I can't remember stuff that I hear. No. But I have to see it in writing before I can remember it. So anyway, that's
– yeah, I had this – I have these conversations with Lynette quite often where she goes – "I told you I was going to New York to do the whatever." And I go, "Here's exactly what you said about this. You said these guys, the fan, were interested in doing this. They said that we'd have a Mangria thing. They said that we could pay for sponsorship, that they would offer." And I go through every single part of it. And then I go, "But we did not discuss this part about you going to New York," which is fine. But I'm just telling you exactly what the exchange was, because that's the way – I'm wired.
And you realize, however impressive that is to me, it's very annoying to your mate.
Well, they could avoid it by not saying, "I told you about this." They could simply go, maybe I forgot to tell you that I'm also going to New York or whatever, in which case, done and done.
Right, as a marriage therapist would say, resentment every time you bring up you, being right doesn't matter.
No, that's a fine point. But what I'm saying is if I read something, I'll have no idea what it is. If you read it to me, I will know. If I hear you say it to me, I will know the time, especially numbers. I'll know the number, the time, the amounts, the whatever it is, the dates. I'll pretty much lock all that off.
And if you tell me something, I won't have any idea 2 minutes later what you told me. And then you'll go, it's Dr. Spaz.
Yeah. Well, if you tell me something, I know. All right. You may have a disability, you may not, but whatever it is, True Car, man. Yeah.
Should have used it last summer.
You should have when Joey got his M3. Yeah. Could have gone apples to apples. True Car, over 700,000 pre-owned vehicles from over 13,000 True Car certified dealers nationwide. Wherever you're looking, if you're looking new, if you're looking used, you look at True Car. Discounts off the list price. You get a better buying experience. It's just a better way of doing things. Look, you know, in the 50s, your dad went down to the dealership, kicked a few tires, haggled a little, and drove away with his new Oldsmobile. This ain't your dad's car dealership. This is True Car. You go online, you find the car you want. It's not a bait and switch thing. You lock in your price, and you go pick up your car. That's it. Certified dealers all over the place. You get a quick, easy, enjoyable buying experience. And whether you're ready to buy, you go True Car. New or used, True Car, TrueCar.com. All right, let's see. One more here. Let's talk to... Now, I don't have a disability because I have a job now where they load up the teleprompter and I just mow it down very easily. But I never taught myself to read. I was having a lot of trouble, again, sequencing in order. I was having trouble moving in order. At some point, I got into a profession where they started handing me papers and saying, read it into the microphone. And I mean, at the very beginning, when I was doing like voiceover work and stuff, they go, yeah, you got the script. And I'd be like, that doesn't help me. Like, it was sad because most people are just like, yeah, no, go in the booth. No, we'll give you the script. You know, you don't have to memorize it. Right. It's a voiceover gig. You know, just put it on an easel right there in front of you and just highlight it and just go ahead and do it. It's like, I couldn't just do it, even highlight it, even right in front of me. And then it was a struggle. And so first thing I did was treat it like a problem. Like, give me the script. Let me take it home the night before. Let me highlight everything. And let me read it and memorize it and rehearse it and go whatever. So I would almost memorize it. Like when we would do the man show monologues at the beginning, I'd pretty much memorize mine, whereas Jimmy would just read his because he could read.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, that's, but probably the visual thing was because you can remember things you hear so well.
Later on, and now, even though I have a certain phobia about, like, uh-oh, teleprompter. The reality is you just put in a teleprompter and I'll just read it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't have that disability anymore.
Yeah, so it's not a disability. You can't do that with dyslexics, I don't think.
No. Yeah. I needed training, and right. I trained it right out of me.
Huh.
It took, you know, a couple decades. I learned how to read. All right, what do you got there?
Smart Mouth. Dual solution oral rinse. It's the only activated mouthwash clinically proven to instantly eliminate bad breath and prevent it from coming back for 12 hours. Zinc ion technology, and you know I'm fascinated by science.
Mm-hmm.
Zinc ion technology binds to bacteria, forcing it to stop producing sulfur. Nothing ruins an intimate moment as quickly as stinky breath. Doesn't matter if you work out all day and drive a Lambo, Adam.
Yeah.
If your mouth smells like wet garbage. Foul breath can ruin social situations, sabotage relationships, or even career prospects. So visit smartmouth.com or find it at Walmart, Target, Walgreens, CVS, or wherever you shop. That's Smart Mouth.
Smart Mouth, baby.
Gotta love those individual pouches. I got those in my car. They're just separated into two. You rip the top off, mix them right there in your mouth, spit them in the street. It's the best.
And yeah, man. Make the street smell better. Fix the street, man.
Just my mouth's fine.
Okay. All right. Let's see. Live shows, Irvine, Oxnard, coming up. Also, me and Gergis, Reasonable Doubt, Town Hall. That's coming up in July. You just go to adamcarolla.com. You want to find out about the cruise, No Safe Spaces, the T-shirts, I Agree With Me, all that stuff. And then Dr. Spaz,
Weekly Infusion. You can hear Dr. Drew asking me questions as if I was a medical student. I love it.
You're good, man. So, until next time, Adam Carolla for Dr. Spaz saying, mahalo.